Well, good evening, everybody. We're going to be continuing our study on end times. Tonight, we had talked about premillennialism and amillennialism last week. We're going to pick up with classic postmillennialism this evening. So, when we take a look at amillennialism, excuse me, I'm on the wrong slide. When we talk about a summary for classic postmillennialism, the items that you must remember that we're going to talk about is what are the main points that identify postmillennialism. Now, remembering that millennialism refers to when Jesus comes back and when the millennium, the thousand-year reign, that is spoken of in the book of Revelation. When does that occur in regards to an eschatological view? So the first point is that classic postmillennialists believe that Jesus returns physically, that he returns after the tribulation and the millennium. So those two events set them apart as being postmillennial, that the tribulation has occurred, the millennial reign has occurred, and now Jesus returns physically. They also believe that there is no rapture before the second coming. They believe that the great tribulation is a conflict between good and evil since Christ's resurrection. They do believe that Christians suffer during the tribulation. And the millennium is a period of peace on earth when the gospel reaches all people. The millennium could be 1,000 years or just a long period of time. They're not constrained to believing that it is a literal 1,000 years. Also, a main point is that the modern state of Israel is not relevant to Revelation prophecy at all. Classic postmillennialism, it began and it kind of started with Joachim of Fiore in 1135 to 1202. He was a 12th century Catholic monk. The zenith of this viewpoint of eschatology was around the turn of the 20th century. It challenges premillennialism for a dominant position in eschatology, and the secular world argues that with modern advances, man has outgrown a need for religion. The second part is that modern state of Israel was not relevant to this model because it did not exist at that time of the turn of the 20th century. And their belief that the Christians do go through the tribulation and the tribulation gives way to the spread of Christianity. During the time of the Industrial Revolution and the turn of the century, all that modernization that was coming about made it a real appealing time of that there was going to be an end to all wars, that the huge surge in missions work that was occurring from the 1860s to the 1900 was one where they were bringing the gospel to the third world countries by the hundreds of the thousands, and the darkest places of Africa that had never heard about Jesus. They had some very strong missionaries. Stanley Livingston is one of them. There's also the ones in Pina, like her last name was Moon. She was a Baptist. Body Moon, that was her name. She was a missionary there. They were in all kinds of countries like India, Burma, Thailand, Siam, Malaysia. All of these countries had a big surge in Western churches, such as the Anglican Church, the Baptists, American Christianity with Methodist Presbyterians. All of these groups sent missionaries by the droves into these foreign countries. And it was through that they believed that the gospel was being spread and it was going to reach the uttermost parts of the earth and to the ends of the earth. And therefore, that what Jesus had called us to do, spread the gospel, go ye therefore into all the world and make disciples of men, that it was about to be fulfilled. And if therefore the gospel was everywhere in the world, there was no more going to be any suffering, because somehow, in a spiritual sense, everyone would know and understand what it meant to be Christian and how to behave as Christians and to walk a Christian life. And so they believed that there was no longer a need for premillennial thought or even amillennial thought, because they had seen such evidence of the growth of through the missionary work and the growth of the gospel being spread. So they didn't believe that, they believed that at that point when the gospel had saturated the globe, that suddenly there would be a peace that would come on the earth, and that would be the mark of the millennium. And they were approaching that very rapidly in their minds. And so whatever the period would be for the millennium would not take much longer until Jesus would return. And they were expecting it any day. The fifth point we have here is that the millennium is a period when the gospel spreads to all the people on the earth, like we just discussed, and that millennial period could be that 1,000 years, and it could be a symbolic representation that there's no rapture for the second coming, Christ returns physically, and then the final judgment and eternity occur after a millennial period. So we have this picture of the post-millennial view. You all have a copy of that picture? In the post-millennial view, you will see that from eternity past, that you have the creation, the fall, then the flood, and the promise of that was given that Jesus would come to save us from our sins. The servant Messiah Jesus, the redemption, is what occurs here. And this is where the event of the cross happened. From that point forward, post-millennial view is that this began the millennium. The world gets Christianized and begins a golden age. And once that golden age begins, that is the marker for them that Jesus will return at any moment. And it could take a day, it could take 10 years, it could take 100 years. But that would be what they would know, is that it could be a long period, it could be a short period, but that's going to begin this time of peace. And then at some point, Jesus returns as King Messiah, and then we have the ushering in of the new creation, the new heavens and the new earth, and then eternity future begins for us. So that's kind of an overview of post-millennialism. I'll give you from a summary standpoint, and we're going to take a look at a little bit more, at a few more things. Post-millennialism actually dates back to the Middle Ages, like I explained before, with Giacomo Fiori. But in the 1880s, when the beginning of the missionary movement would lead all people to receiving the gospel and culminate in that millennial period, is when it reached its zenith. The popularity of this model was greatly diminished, however, with World War I and the Great Depression. In the 1880s, 90s, 1900, 1910, everyone felt that believed in this system is that we were very strongly going to realize this time of peace. In 1914, with the outbreak of World War I, which was called the Great War, the war to end all wars, because it was such a horrific thing that happened in Europe, it really disillusioned many people. And following quickly behind that was a small period in some places, of wealth and things that was during the Roaring Twenties. But in some places, the economy was still very depressed, and then it slid into the Great Depression, beginning in the early 1930s and culminating in the horrific World War II, with the slaughter of millions and millions of people. 6 million Jews, 12 million Russians Eastern Europeans were murdered as well. So it was a very horrific time period. The scriptural support for this you will find in Matthew 24, verse 14. If someone could read that. So in this verse, in Matthew 24, verse 14, where it describes the gospel of the kingdom being preached into the whole world as the testimony to all nations, by it saying, and then the end will come. Because of that huge surge in the missionary movement, they expected, well, we've preached the gospel onto all the continents, all these little places, so therefore Jesus must be coming in an immediate moment. The other verse is in Mark chapter 13, verse 10. You can turn your Bibles there. And Mark 13:10 says, and the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Okay, so that's their scriptural reference. In regards to the second coming and the resurrection of all people, saved and unsaved, will occur at the same time. You could turn over to the book of Daniel. And we would be looking at Daniel chapter 12, verse 2 through 3. Daniel 12, verse 2 and 3 says, multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So this is another proof text for them. And then over in the Gospel of John chapter 5, verse 28, and in John 5, 28, it says, "Do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done good will rise to live, and those who have done evil will rise to be condemned." So John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. So these are their texts that they use for supporting their view that it is an immediate, when Jesus returns, there will be an immediate resurrection. Famous post-millennialists that we have, that these are ones who strongly promoted this. We will start with Jonathan Edwards. He was a revivalist preacher and philosopher. He was a Congregationalist that was a Protestant theologian. Like most of the Puritans, he held to the Reformed theology. One of his famous sermons, which is recognized by many, are Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which he wrote in 1741. The professor of theology at Princeton Seminary was B.B. Warfield. He taught from 1887 to 1921. Some conservative Presbyterians consider him to be the last of the great Princeton theologians before the split in 1929 that formed the Westminster Theological Seminary and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. He was author of The Witness of the Stars in 1893. The Making of the Westminster Confession, and The Inspiration and Authority of the Bible. The next famous person that prominent postmillennialist is Augustus Strong. He is a Baptist minister and theologian who lived in the United States during the 19th and early 20th centuries. He was the author of A Systematic Theology that proved to be a mainstay of Reformed Baptist theological education for several generations. The next person is Charles Hodge. He was an important Presbyterian theologian and principal of Princeton Theological Seminary between 1851 and 1878, and he was a leading exponent of the Princeton theology, an Orthodox Calvinist theological tradition in America during the 19th century. He argued strongly for the authority of the Bible as the Word of God. Many of his ideas were adopted in the 20th century by fundamentalists as well as evangelicals. He was an author also of A Systematic Theology from 1872 and 1873. The last one we have in our list of prominent postmillennialists is Robert L. Dabney. He is an American Christian theologian, a Southern Presbyterian pastor, a Confederate States Army chaplain and architect. He was also chief of staff and biographer to Stonewall Jackson, and his biography of Jackson remains in print today. He was the author of The Life of General Thomas J. Jackson in 1866, a defense of Virginia and through her of the South in recent and pending contest against the sectional party in 1867. This was an apologia for the Confederacy. Lectures on Sacred Rhetoric in 1870, Syllabus and Notes of the Course of Systematic and Polemic Theology in 1871, and later republished as A Systematic Theology in 1878. Sensualistic Philosophy of the 19th Century examined in 1875. These, there are, when we look at the writings of these men, you can see that there are certain things that we can agree upon, and there's other things that we won't agree upon because of their culture and their belief system they had at the time of their lives. So that's basically post-millennialism in a nutshell, from a summary level, as to what it is, how it works. So we're going to move on to the idealism or the allegorical view. And in the idealism or the allegorical view, idealism, which is also the allegorical view, is also called the spiritual approach, the allegorical approach, the non-literal approach, and it also goes by many other names. In Christian eschatology, it is an interpretation of the book of Revelation that sees all of the imagery of the book as symbols. Jacob Taubes, from 1923 to 1987, was a sociologist of religion, philosopher, a scholar of Judaism. He writes that idealist eschatology came about as Renaissance thinkers began to doubt that the kingdom of heaven had been established on earth or would be established, but still believed in its establishment. Rather than the kingdom of heaven being present in society, it is established subjectively for the individual. F.D. Maurice, from 1805 to 1872, was a major theologian of the Church of England, a prolific author, and one of the founders of Christian socialism. Since World War II, interest in Maurice has expanded. He interpreted the Kingdom of Heaven idealistically as a symbol representing society's general improvement instead of a physical and political kingdom. Karl Barth, from 1886 to 1968, was a Swiss Reformed theologian who is often regarded as the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century. He interprets eschatology as representing existential truths that bring the individual hope, rather than history or future history. Barth's ideas provided fuel for the social gospel philosophy in America, which saw social change not as performing required good works, but rather because the individuals involved felt that Christians could not simply ignore society's problems with future dreams. The idealist view of eschatology maintains that the book of Revelation is to be interpreted symbolically as describing the conflict between good and evil. The events of Revelation cannot be interpreted as describing specific events, people, or places. The book of Revelation is a symbolic representation of the ongoing struggle between good and evil and demonstrates that ultimate victory belongs to God. In other words, the idealism model views the book of Revelation metaphorically as a metaphor for the ongoing struggle between good and evil. One view of how to read Revelation from the idealism model is that the seals, trumpets, and bowls seem to repeat the sequence of events in a sort of telescoping pattern. The same retelling of the events gets more intense as you move from the seals to the trumpets to the bowls. It can also be viewed as telling the same event from a different perspective, or that the different telling of the same event could represent a different telling of the same event to a different one of the seven churches in a different way. I've not been able to pin down exactly when the model known as idealism came to existence. There have not been people expressing views along these lines for at least as far back as the Protestant Reformation. This model is sometimes paired with other models such as the postmillennial model or the preterist view, and many in the idealist camp would dismiss this dispensational premillennial model as cult-like at best and downright horrible theology at worst that promotes a separatist worldview. Separatist in that Christians can depend on the rapture to rescue them from the worst events that might unfold in the Middle East, though instead of working to resolve conflicts in the area and bringing lasting peace, it encourages just writing it off as a lost cause that can only end in the Battle of Armageddon. Idealism as a formal model is also new enough that it is still being defined and redefined by some thinkers. So that is, in a nutshell, the four major groupings of what we tend to talk about with regard to eschatology. Dispensational, premillennial are kind of paired together. The allegorical idealists, preterists and historicists, and the futurist dispensationalists. And the when we talk about millennialism is what tends to come in how we begin to speak of each one of these. Now, when we take a look at having had all of these items that we have discussed at this point, we have within us a definition of the terms that we need to know and understand what's going to happen and how these people think about it, what's going to happen, and so that we can have a conversation and understand the dialogue. We know that there is things to talk about millennialism, whether it's pre, post, or allegorical. All of those things are those different views of when these events for the end times is going to occur. In the allegorical view, in the timeline that we have, for them, there is no millennium. There is, they do recognize that historically things have happened with the creation, the fall, the flood, the promise, and Jesus appearing. But his return is at the end, and there's a question. Is he really going to physically come back, or is it just, we enter into that euphoric utopia that is a new creation? They don't even recognize that there will be a new heaven and earth, because everything in the book of Revelation that talks about those two events are spiritualized and not really, in their opinion, a real event happened. So that's how the allegorical or the idealist view works. When we take a look at delving into how to study about end time, there is an outline that I tend to use. And the first thing that we do is that number one, we go to the scriptures to find out what it says about end time. The very first thing we will take a look at are the words of Jesus himself. We will find these in the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In particular, Matthew 24 and 25, Mark chapter 13, and the gospel of Luke chapters 21. Second thing that we will take a look at are the writings of Paul. This will be from his letters where he talks about end times. In particular, the book of Thessalonians will be one of the places we will pull from. Third thing that we will take a look at is the book of Daniel. And the reason that we go back to the Old Testament at that point is because Jesus himself refers to Daniel and his writing during the Olivet Discourse. And in particular, because Daniel is referred to, he is making a point that this is important. This is like a key for you to understand what I'm talking about. The fourth thing that we take a look at then are the other writings in the Old Testament with Ezekiel, Joel, and Zechariah. Two minor prophets and one of the major prophets, being Ezekiel. We will take a look at those. Ezekiel in particular does take a view of things at the end times, a battle scene that does appear there, but also from a millennial perspective when he talks about the new temple. So we take a look at those things with Ezekiel. Joel uses some of the same imagery that Jesus refers to, as well as Paul, and so we will look at those. Zechariah also has imagery that correlates very closely in the book of Revelation. If you begin to understand these books and what they say, it begins to give you the key to unlock what is written by John in the book of Revelation. And so this is the reason we take all of these other pieces in the beginning before we get to the book of Revelation itself. In the words of Jesus, we particularly look at the Olivet Discourse, where he talks about the beginning of the end. Matthew 24, verse 9, talks about then, and Mark 13, 9, Luke 21, 12, things of before. The disciples asked three questions. The first question they asked was, when will these things, the destruction of the temple, happen? And what will be the sign of your coming? In other words, your kingdom. And the third question they asked is, what is the sign of the end of the age? In other words, the Gentile oppression. So these are the questions that the disciples asked Jesus that prompted the Olivet Discourse. The Olivet Discourse meaning on the Mount of Olives in the afternoon in the week following Palm Sunday, where Jesus had visited the temple and they were saying, in fact, let's just turn to Matthew chapter 24. Jesus left, starting in verse 1, Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. I tell you the truth. Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, so obviously he's made a little trip from the temple up to the Mount of Olives, and he was sitting on the Mount of Olives that afternoon, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And then Jesus begins in verse 4 to tell them what's going to happen, and we'll take a look at this in depth. But the reason that we take this format is that we're doing precept upon precept. Like I described in our first Bible study, that we take the foundation and we build on it, but using Scripture to build that view, build that structure that we can understand what it is. Now, we will refer to the things that we use in modern terminology for eschatology and theology to understand how those things relate to what is written here in the Bible, so that we can see and understand clearly what everyone kind of thinks things are and when they happen. So the first thing we're going to take a look at is in Matthew chapter 24, verse 3. As Jesus was on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately that we just read about. And in verse 4, Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." And then in verse 6 it says, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come." Verse 7 says, "Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places." And verse 8, "All these are the beginning of birth pains." Now, The little timeline that I have on here, and I hope you can see it, it shows that Jesus ended his ministry here on this earth because of his death and resurrection at the cross. A few years later, about 40 years later, the temple that he had been viewing with his disciples on that afternoon just before his death on the cross, Herod's temple as it is sometimes known, it is the second temple that was created, was destroyed by Titus in 70 AD. The destruction of the temple in 70 AD was fulfilling what Jesus said, there will not be one stone left upon another. And so the temple in Jerusalem was completely destroyed. They tore down most of its walls as well. So there was literally nothing left. When they set fire to the building, in fact, all the lining of the temple, which were solid gold, ran down from the intense heat, and they filled the cracks between the stones. And because they filled the cracks between the stones, the Roman soldiers pulled the stones apart because none of the stones were mortared together instructions to build the temple had to be, the stones had to be cut and fashioned, but they were to be just put together. They were not to be mortared together. There would be no mortaring and no pins or anything. So because they were loose, so to speak, even though each of the temple stones probably weighed about a ton apiece, being solid rock, the Roman soldiers just pulled it all down, pulled them apart so they could pull out the gold once it cooled down. So that's the reason why there wasn't a stone left on another. They had literally just pulled everything apart. It wasn't just that they burned the building. The next event that occurs in this scene is that Jesus returns to earth. And then it begins the 1,000-year reign on the earth, and it culminates in the great white throne judgment just before eternity. Now, this view is a pre-millennial view, and that will be the view that I will be teaching from. I will refer to the other formats, but I'm not really going to focus on amillennialism or allegorical view as they are very late in being understood from the scriptures. And I really want us to focus on getting things as close to the time of the writers of the New Testament as possible. So the premillennial view being the first view that was understood by the apostles and the early church fathers, the earliest of the early church fathers, will be the position that we will speak from on our charts, even though there are other views, and we will talk about some of the items as it comes along where there is an important difference and may need to be highlighted. But this is a premillennial view, and that's where that Jesus comes before the millennium. In Mark chapter 13, verse 3, as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us when these things will happen and what will be the sign that they are all about to be fulfilled." Now, I kind of stressed on some of those words so that you would understand they wanted to know when, they wanted to know a sign, but they referred to about to be fulfilled. In other words, they weren't asking him to specify the date that it would happen, but just so that they would get a sense of what's coming. And Jesus said to them in verse 5, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming I am he," meaning Messiah or the Christ, "and will deceive many." So in verse 7, he says, "When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come." And in verse 8, "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of birth pangs." And it really repeats the same model on a timeline that we had out of the book of Matthew. In Luke 21, verse 7, it says, "Teacher," they asked, "when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of that they are about to take place?" And he replied in verse 8, "Watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name claiming I am he, and the time is near," another phrase, "do not follow them." He gives an imperative, a statement, a command that says, do not follow them. In verse 9, he continues on by saying, "When you hear of wars and revolutions, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away." Now, we have three Gospels, three people writing that understand that Jesus said something about the end time. There are several statements here that are in quotes that Jesus talked. Now, some people may take a look and say, well, nobody got it right. Or perhaps everyone got it right, but they only reported the part that they thought was important. The writers of the Synoptic Gospels had an audience in mind that they were going to to distribute their information to about the story of Jesus and the story of the gospel to tell people. Matthew wrote it from the perspective of speaking to Jews. Mark wanted to give a report that was quick, fast, and let's get the highlights out to people. He was the first writer. Matthew followed second. And the third writer was Luke, who was writing to a Greek Gentile, Theophilus. And in writing to his, he was giving a historical view of the, and he had done many interviews with people that had actually talked with Jesus. But he himself was not an eyewitness. John Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark, also was not an eyewitness. However, he was very close at that time and had spoken with many of the apostles being at the Jerusalem church. Matthew would have been the only one who was an eyewitness to these. And so we tend to take all three of these men's writings as a combination. And so that's why we take all three of the synoptic gospels together for each step so that we can see and understand a three-dimensional or a 360 view of what was said at the Olivet Discourse. Continuing on in verse 10, of Luke chapter 21, Jesus then said to them, "Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilence in various places, and fearful events, and great signs from heaven." Now, this model also follows with the same timeline of being a premillennial view. So how did Jesus respond to these three questions? When will these things, the destruction of the temple, happen? Well, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD by the Roman general Titus, who was the son of Caesar Vespasian. Vespasian was the emperor at the time, and upon his death, Titus became Caesar. At this moment in 70 AD, all the Jews from Jerusalem and major cities were relocated as slaves throughout the Roman Empire. And at this moment, Israel was no longer a nation in 70 AD. So, in 70 AD, there's still Jews in the land of Israel, but the main people in the main cities, the priests, the businessmen, anybody of the nobility class, all of those were exported as slaves. But they left people like the shepherds and the potters and, you know, those other kinds of people that were going to keep things going in the country to support the Roman occupation as servants or slaves. They left them there, which would play into future events in 135 and 160 AD, and there was further persecutions against the Jews and further Jewish wars. But at this point, in 70 AD, Israel ceased to be a nation, and it was occupied under Rome. The next thing that Jesus said in his response to the three questions, and this is the question, when will these things, in other words, the destruction of the temple, happen? In Matthew 24, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name." Luke 21:9, "You will hear of wars and revolutions, do not be frightened." All these things must happen, but don't be frightened. The end is still yet to come. Now, certainly we have seen in the 20th century, we've seen World War I, World War II, we have seen the Boer Wars, we've seen the Boxer Rebellion, we've seen Vietnam, we've seen the Holocaust, fearful events. We've seen Desert Storm, the war in Iraq, we've seen the Afghan War. We have seen a tremendous amount of wars all over the world. We have also seen a great rise in the amount of earthquakes. In fact, one of the geophysicists recently said that there appears to be a 300% increase in the amount of earthquakes throughout the Ring of Fire just within the past few years, and they're greatly concerned that there will be a massive earthquake or volcanic eruption of tremendous impact to the Earth and its atmosphere. There are quite a few rumblings of the super volcano that lies underneath Yellowstone National Park, for example. The activity there is increasing rapidly. If it were to erupt, it would disrupt things throughout the globe, air travel, air quality, all those type of things on a massive global level. So we also have seen things like Ebola and AIDS and some other kinds of diseases and increases of cancer and some other types of things. So there's a lot of things when it talks about pestilence, famines, earthquakes. The famines in Africa as well as in Australia were severe just within the past 5 to 7 years. So there's quite a bit here for us to think about. Jesus said all these things have to happen, and yet the end still has yet to come. One of the things that it says in Luke chapter 21, verse 9, is the very last one that says, and great signs from heaven. Now, in particular, we have here in 2016, we have just passed the year 2015, in which there was this tremendous display of the blood moon, as well as in conjunction with Jewish feasts of Passover and Yom Kippur and the Feast of Tabernacles. All of those were centering around the Jewish holidays with a blood moon, which is certainly one of the signs that we will see very soon. Super moons that were seen at the largest or the closest to the earth, where they were being viewed, whether they were viewed here in the U.S., and in particular, the last one that was in view in Jerusalem. So these signs are quite particular and striking. In addition to those, we also had solar eclipses occurring during those time periods. In the past, for these tetrads to occur, it has been many, many years since we've had a tetrad of this magnitude. And in particular, the last and final one that we observed was it occurred during the year of Jubilee. So that is, in particular, it was the 49th Jubilee. So the entire symbolism of the Jewish feast of restoration is not lost upon anyone who is a student of biblical history, as well as scriptural writings, and in particular eschatology. Matthew 24, verse 9, Jesus said, and then you will be handed over to be persecuted and to be put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of many will of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached into the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. So we have the answer. The end will come when the gospel is preached to the whole earth. And as of today, the translators that are trying to translate the Bible into all the known languages, they're about 94% complete. And there are several nations that don't, and language groups that don't have it in their hands yet, but they have made a tremendous rush forward. I think about 5 years ago, they had 200 language groups yet to go. I think they're down to 70, somewhere around there. Don't quote me on the numbers, but they have made a tremendous impact in towards reducing that number so that they can complete all of the language, get the gospel into the hands of all the language groups. So it isn't just a matter, and I know that Wycliffe translators, it pushes the written word to being that marker. But the other marker is that what it says in the scripture is the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And we certainly have other areas where people are, like the New Testament League, which are translating, taking little testament and distributing them in foreign countries. There is the radio station that are being set up in various countries, like Europe, that broadcasts behind the Iron Curtain. To give during the communist Cold War era, that was trying to preach the gospel into those areas. We have the internet where people are trying to focus on getting the gospel and sermons and materials into the Muslim countries or the communist nations that still are around, like China and Malaysia, Burma, Myanmar, some of those type of places. We still have a lot of resistance from foreign countries. In fact, the country of India has pretty much closed its borders for any missionaries to come in. And they're, if that's what you are known to be doing, then they don't want you there. They won't allow you to come in. But there are other places where they will actually throw you in jail, and you may lose your life. Iran, Myanmar, Cambodia, some of those other types of nations, Singapore, Malaysia, those are all throughout the Indonesian area. In particular, North Korea would be another one. In particular, what they are trying, it's mostly the Muslim nations that we have, that are trying to prevent anyone from coming in to preach the gospel. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Turkey, these are places that are, some of them have varying degrees of tolerance, and some of them have no tolerance whatsoever. But we are trying to get the gospel out into all of these different various countries. The other thing that it says in here is that there will be an increase of wickedness and the love of most will grow cold. Right now, the church in Western in Western culture has had a huge drop in the amount of attendance at church, people who describe themselves as Christian. The decline within some of our strongest denominations has taken a nosedive here in America. Within just the past 5 years, there's been a tremendous dip in people that in church. Trying to grow or is very, very difficult, but even to maintain stability. Right now, I think I heard a statistic that there's 1,700 churches in America that closes its doors every day. That's a lot of churches. So any church that has its doors open they're attempting to keep things together, to keep it moving. So it's important that we pray. And I think that that's one of the biggest messages I have for these particular verses out of Matthew 24:9, is that, yes, we do see the love of many growing cold. A lot of people they feel disenfranchised by the church or by the clergy. They feel disenfranchised by the right, so to speak, politically. And so they are leaving anything that looks like, smells like Christian church. That's old-fashioned. We don't need this. We need to be more liberal. We need to live our lives the way we want to. We should not be held accountable to anything. Experimenting with forms of morality, experimenting with forms of sexuality, all these experimental things that are being pushed towards a libertine lifestyle are things that are going on in our culture. And the very foundations of the Judeo-Christian culture of America has been under extreme pressure over the past decade, and it is only increasing. But Jesus says, these things will happen. But for us to stand firm. And in standing firm, this is where we take that look at, what does God in his purpose and plan want me to do? What is my part that I can play in this type of environment in the last days? Because the last days is no longer that thing of, well, it's something that will happen way off in the future. It's actually things that we can see are happening right now, and more so as we get into more details of current things. But I want to challenge you tonight to think about, what is it that I can do right now from these verses? What is my part to play? Is God calling me? Stand firm. Yes, he is. He's making that call. He wants you to stand firm. He doesn't want you to be swayed by the culture. He doesn't want you to be transformed by your environment. And he doesn't want you to be frightened of the events of this world. He wants you to stay confident. He wants you to stay full of faith and trusting in him. So if you can stand firm yourself with your belief system and what you feel that God has spoken to you through this verse that says, I need to stand firm and hold on to his truth, his plan, and his purpose, what is the next step that he wants you to do that he's called you to? And that's what I believe, and I would like to challenge you, is to pray, because others around you may be struggling with being firm and standing and holding on to the truths and the precepts that God has given us. They may be frightened by things that are the events that are happening in this world. They may be struggling with the pull of their friends and their peers trying to persuade them to give up morality or delve into experimentation and exploration of things that are immoral or philosophical in a way that they don't want to or need to trust in God and the Word of God anymore. So I would encourage you tonight that prayer for those that you know in your sphere of influence, your network, for you to pray for each one. Those that you know are Christians, begin to pray for them, that they will stand firm, that they will not be tempted to go in other types of directions, but that they would indeed stand very firm, strong in their belief. And I think we're going to stop there tonight and start to ask questions.